Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Werke, Judge Bond, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Court of Appeals, April 24. We have three matters on our oral calendar this morning. The first is file A24-1584, State of Minnesota, is the respondent versus Jared James Sprouls as appellant. As counsel are aware, we are recording and live streaming these proceedings, and so no other recording is allowed absent prior approval. We do therefore also ask that counsel identify yourself by name and who you represent when you begin your comments. We also ask that you keep an eye on the clock, which you'll see on the right, I believe, part of the podium, and also there's a adjustment button in the front face of it to adjust it to your comfort. And with those comments in mind, counsel for appellant, you may approach and when ready, identify yourself and begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Hannah Laub, and I represent the appellant, Jared Sprouls. We're asking this court to reverse Mr. Sprouls' conviction for threats of violence for insufficient evidence. Alternatively, we ask this court to grant Mr. Sprouls a new trial where he is allowed a voluntary intoxication jury instruction. Mr. Sprouls was severely intoxicated, pinned face down on his kitchen floor by two different officers, and had his hands handcuffed behind his back when he asked the officers why they were on him and said that he would kill them. Moments later, they told Mr. Sprouls that they wanted to let him get up if he would calm down, and 3 minutes later, the officers let Mr. Sprouls walk freely around the room while in handcuffs. He was confused and upset that the officers were in his home that he owned. He had been asleep after a night of drinking, and his roommate woke him up to let him know that officers were in the house, responding to an alleged domestic situation between another one of their roommates and that roommate's girlfriend.
Ms. Laub, if I can interrupt you just for a second. On the reasonable apprehension element of threats of violence charge, for that element in particular, are you arguing the sufficiency challenge under a direct or a circumstantial evidence standard of review?
A circumstantial evidence standard of review. There's no direct evidence.
Well, there is direct evidence. The body cam, and I'll speak for myself, but I'm sure my colleagues also reviewed the body cam. I mean, that's evidence. We're watching it.
Oh, I absolutely agree that the body cam is evidence. But I would say you can't have direct evidence of reasonableness because there has to be an inference that you're making in order to say that something is reasonable, if that makes sense. There's also a circumstantial evidence of review for the conscious disregard element as well.
That one is clearly a mens rea. I don't disagree with that. But the reasonable element seems a little bit different because it's not a state of mind. It's a reasonable person standard. Is there any other case law where Minnesota courts apply a circumstantial evidence standard of review to a objective element like that?
Not that I'm aware of. I would just argue that there's no direct evidence that something is reasonable. You have to make an inference, right, that something is reasonable when you look at the facts. But even if you did decide it on a direct evidence standard of review, I believe the element still wasn't met. Because you have to look at the threat, how it was made in context. And in the context, Mr. Sprouls was unarmed. The officers knew he was unarmed. They dispelled that suspicion when they walked in and they looked at his waistband and saw that he was, you know, putting his pants on.
They did have knowledge when they entered that there was possibly a firearm on the property, right?
Correct. So they had knowledge that there was possibly a firearm involved with the parties that were called, that the call was made for. And so the officers knew that wasn't Mr. Sprouls. They discovered that very early on, almost immediately when coming into the house. So they knew there was a firearm, but between the parties, and they had seen Mr. Sprouls on his person. The officer had actually put his firearm away after he realized that Mr. Sprouls wasn't armed. So they realized Mr. Sprouls wasn't the one with the firearm.
So there's two threats, right? Two distinct threats, but one charge, correct?
Correct, yes.
So do we need, if we were to find the evidence was sufficient as to one of the threats, do we need, hypothetically, do we need to consider the second threat?
I think you do need to consider all of the threats, but I think the fact that the first threat, how the officers reacted to that, informs how the second alleged threat wasn't actually threatening. Because after the first alleged threat, Mr. Sprowls, you know, immediately was allowed to kind of calm himself down. The officer responded to the roommate saying, "It's okay, it's okay." And within 3 minutes, Mr. Sprowls was able to walk around the apartment while handcuffed, but allowed to freely walk around. He had no reason to believe that the officers would respond to any sort of second threats of, "I wish we could be in California so I could shoot you," with extreme fear, when he had just directly said, "I'm going to kill you." And from his perspective, they did not respond with extreme fear. They kind of ignored it and were just trying to calm him down. So I think the second alleged threat, which I believe is also not a threat because he said, "I wish," which I talked about in my brief. But even if you kind of didn't, if the wish part wasn't dispositive, I think the fact that, with every threat, it had to be made in conscious disregard of a substantial and unjustifiable risk that his words or conducts would cause extreme fear. And in context, he had just said, "I'm going to kill you," and they didn't honestly react with much fear, certainly not extreme fear. So he would have no reason to think that, "I wish I was in California so I could shoot you," subsequent to that, would cause extreme fear.
How do you respond to respondent's argument that on that "I wish" statement, that State versus Olson is different in terms of the words that were used, and so that Olson doesn't really apply here where your client said, "I wish I could"?
Right. I mean, I think there is a difference there, certainly, in Olson, right? He said, "I understand why people want to, harass or shoot," or whatever the language was, "police officers." He also said, "I hope something happens to you," right? Not saying, "I wish I could do something to you." But I think Olson still is very applicable because Olson, the issue there was the first element, which there was no communication of an intention to injure another. And I think the same is here true. There was no communication of an actual intent to kill another. He said, "I wish we were in California so I could shoot you," which was, his perception. And I don't think it actually indicates a communication to get them to California where he could shoot him in a theoretical different situation. So I think Olson is still also very applicable in that Olson was very intoxicated and he was frustrated with his arrest, and those circumstances also informed the court's decision that that was not a true threat that he was making or recklessly disregarding making.
Ms. Lam, if we accept your argument, standard of review is the circumstantial, and I'm thinking right now the reckless disregard element. Given the fact that the jury heard testimony about his extreme intoxication, but also saw the same body cam that we have in the record, what reasonable inference, what of the facts proved support a reasonable inference other than guilt?
The reasonable inference other than guilt, I think there's a couple that one could make, that he was too intoxicated to consciously disregard anything. I think the other reasonable inference...
But isn't that one necessarily rejected by the jury's verdict in the prong one of the circumstantial evidence test? Because they heard all that evidence and nevertheless, with the instructions given, found him guilty.
Well, I think if you were to find that, the other option would be that the reasonable inference inconsistent with guilt is that he didn't think the words that he were saying would cause an unjustifiable risk of extreme fear in the officers, considering the circumstances, considering he was handcuffed, unarmed, severely intoxicated. There were three officers in the room. There were two holding his body down. I think the circumstances there's an inference that he didn't think that the officers would have extreme fear. And it's important that extreme fear is the standard because otherwise it could run afoul of the First Amendment. The fact that the state has to prove that Mr. Sprowls thought that there was a substantial risk that there would be a cause of extreme fear, that's a safeguard so that only true threats are punished. We don't want to be punishing language that's not a true threat because then it raises a lot of First Amendment concerns, which I believe Counterman versus Colorado comes into play as well when we talk about the jury instructions, which, unless there's more questions, I'd like to turn to if possible. Um, Minnesota Statute 609.075, we believe, applies to recklessness crimes. That's because the statute reads that when a particular intent or other state of mind is a necessary element to constitute a particular crime, that's when you get that voluntary intoxication.
You're only challenging the third prong of our test for that?
Yes.
What, if I could take you to the obstructing legal process statute, what is the precise language in the statute that you're relying on for your argument that it's a specific intent crime?
For the obstruction?
Mm-hmm.
Give me a moment. So 609.02, the mental state, it says when criminal intent is an element of a crime in this chapter, such intent is indicated by the term intentionally, the phrase with intent to, et cetera. The statute itself for obstruction just states whoever intentionally obstructs, essentially, is guilty of a crime. So when we look at how to interpret the mental state there, we go to the statutory definition of intentionally, which is essentially a specific intent. Intentionally, in subdivision 3 of 609.02, says the actor must have knowledge of those facts which are necessary to make the actor's conduct criminal and which are set forth after the word intentionally. A specific intent crime requires an intent to cause a particular result, and a general intent in crime just means not accidentally. And so when it comes to obstruction, I think it's also helpful to think of a hypothetical where if there's somebody trying to come into your house, right, and they're banging on the door, and you don't want these people in your house, it's your own home, you're pushing back up against the door, and you're trying to get them not to come in. If you don't know who that is, then that's not obstruction of process. If that is a police officer, and you know it's a police officer, and you're trying to stop them from following through with a search warrant, then that would be obstruction. If you're just trying to keep somebody out of your house, and you have you're not accidentally, right, keeping the door closed, but you are doing it with the intent, not knowing that it's a police officer, that's, I think, an example that can kind of highlight why it's not a general intent crime.
But that, I mean, that hypothetical might make sense if the statute said acts with intent to obstruct. But here it says intentionally obstruct. And, I mean, I think the legislature has written any number of statutes that use the word intentionally in combination with something else, and those are generally general intent crimes, aren't they? I mean, part of what I'm struggling with your argument is it seems then that any statute where the legislature uses the word intentionally becomes a specific intent crime, and I don't think that's really where we're authorized to go.
Well, I do think the statutory definition of intentionally indicates, it literally says that you must have the facts and the knowledge that makes the criminal act criminal, right? Or makes the act criminal. And this court also wouldn't have to hold that everything that says intentionally or that has a recklessness standard for their mens rea would have to get a voluntary intoxication instruction. Because I think the fact that it is a speech crime, makes it particularly important that those types of crimes have that mens rea that has to be proven. And that's where Counterman versus Colorado comes in and says, it is an essential element that the state proves a mens rea element. Because otherwise, people are going to be, you know, steering very clear of the culpable speech, which would include chilling, right, non-criminal speech. And the statute itself for voluntary intoxication says a particular intent or other state of mind is a necessary element. And Counterman versus Colorado makes it clear that another state of mind is recklessness, and it is very important to prove. State versus Burgum also said.
How does Counterman versus Colorado help your argument exactly? Because, I mean, it's a First Amendment case, and it seemed to just require this recklessness standard in order to not run afoul of the First Amendment, which is a standard we've already got in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So how does Counterman change your position?
I think it kind of changes the reading of 609.075. which says when a particular intent or other state of mind is a necessary element to constitute a particular crime. This court has never reached the decision whether recklessness counts as that other state of mind. And I think the fact that it says a necessary element, Countervern versus Colorado kind of tells us this is a necessary element. You have to prove mens rea, or else we are running the risk of running afoul of the First Amendment.
Ms. Lama, how do you overcome the harmless error part of the analysis, even if we were to accept your argument in terms of specific intent, given the fact that there was a plethora of evidence to the jury of intoxication and extreme intoxication, and that they saw the intoxication from the video?
I would point you to the state's closing argument, where they actually pointed out that the jury was not instructed on voluntary intoxication. They said, quote, "You've heard about intoxication and the fact that the defendant was drinking that night and was intoxicated, but I would note to you, you haven't been instructed in your jury instructions that intoxication is as a legal defense to any of these charges." I think there's plain error right there and prejudice right there. If you're a lay jury and you hear the state say that in their closing argument, actually in their second closing argument, then you might think, we can't consider intoxication. I mean, she just told us, right? You've heard a lot about this intoxication, but you're not actually allowed to use that as a legal defense. I think as a lay jury, you would think, we can't use that at all. And I see I've reached my time.
And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal, counsel. Thank you. Counsel for respondent, when you're ready, you may approach, identify yourself, and begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent respondent, state of Minnesota, in this matter. The two most important things that appellant said in this case were, nah, and I'm going to fucking kill you. He said nah after one of his roommates had said, just be cool, don't go to prison. He rejected that advice. He said nah. And then, after a lot of swearing and physical belligerence, he says to the officer in a very angry voice, which you've all heard, I'm going to fucking kill you. So this wasn't protected speech. No one's claiming that. And in light of everything that happened here, it wasn't just some out of the blue, out of character, transitory anger that quickly passed. Appellant was a very angry drunk that night. You've seen and heard that. And this statement was the culmination of him really getting up in the face of the officer and having to be taken down, and all of his swearing and all of his creative and colorful and sometimes fairly offensive insults to the various officers. So the only question here is whether the officer's apprehension was reasonable, because the officer testified to his apprehension, and you have to presume the officer wasn't lying to the jury. So the only question for you is whether you're going to say, as a matter of law, an officer can't take this sort of thing seriously. It just wasn't reasonable. A lot of appellant's argument seems to turn on, well, he couldn't have killed him right then and there. There were other officers. There were cops there. But the Jones case that appellant cites, where this court actually upheld a finding of terroristic threats, threats of violence, involved someone in prison saying, in 3 months, I'm going to hunt you down and kill you. So clearly there isn't a requirement that you have to kill them right then and there, be able to, for an officer to have what's legally reasonable apprehension.
Mr. Raggetts, would you agree? I mean, when I watch the video, one of the things that strikes me is, as appellant's counsel argues, the officers they appear pretty relaxed in their speech and their conduct. Do you disagree with that characterization? I mean, to me, that supports if circumstantial evidence applies to the reasonable apprehension element. Why wouldn't that support a reasonable inference that there was no reasonable apprehension? I mean, they don't portray that in their conduct that they're in extreme fear.
Well, yeah, the cops did a good job here. If you watch it, they remained calm. They didn't respond to some of the really offensive insults thrown in their faces. But again, we don't have to show that the cops had a fear that within the next 10 minutes he's going to kill me. That's clear under Jones. And the officer testified I was apprehensive about this. So you have to believe that under any standard of review. So the only question, again, is whether it's reasonable. And I'm not aware of any case law that's ever said you apply circumstantial evidence to whether something is reasonable as a matter of law. I mean, the reasonable test comes up in lots of different circumstances. And so I don't know how you'd say there is an inference that it's not reasonable. I think under Jones, and frankly, appellant hasn't cited any case law that says, as a matter of law, it's not reasonable for police officers to be concerned when someone says angrily, "I'm going to fucking kill you." That officers just have to let it go off their back. They can't be worried about it. That's not part of the job. It shouldn't be for an officer, just like it isn't for a judge or a congressman. You don't get to do this when it's not transitory anger, and it clearly wasn't here. So the reasonableness question is really not a close question. And the other question here is conscious disregard, and that's where the drunkenness comes in. And clearly he was very drunk. No one's disputed that. The officers testified to that. But he also clearly wasn't so drunk that he can't be held responsible for the choices he made, like the choice to say nah to his roommate when his roommate says, "Hey, man, just be cool." I mean, he's able to go upstairs. He's able to respond to the officer's questions. He's able to respond to the officer's statements with various insults and lots of swearing. He's able to ask the officer's questions. He's able to ask the police to explain to him politely while they're in his home. He's able to tell the police, "I've been calm from the get-go," even though that clearly wasn't true. I mean, this is not someone who's so drunk that they just can't be held responsible for anything. And if you look at the couple of the cases cited in my brief, where you have people who are in the middle of a meth bender and are paranoid and can't even recognize their own girlfriends, even that wasn't enough to get over the conscious disregard hurdle. And so clearly we don't have that here. You've seen the video.
And, you know, appellant also argues that there's something significant about the length of time of this interaction and the number of times Mr. Sprowls had to ask, "Why are you here? Why are you here? Why are you here?" Which also is I think, a little bit of a different scenario than often pops up in a threats or violence case. So why aren't those circumstances proved enough to support an inference that he wasn't acting in conscious disregard because he was too intoxicated to understand what was happening?
Well, what he kept coming back to is, "You don't have a warrant. You can't be here without a warrant." And they didn't have a warrant. That's true. But you don't need a warrant in a domestic violence where you've got an indication there may be some strangulation going on. So he was just wrong about the law, and he was so convinced he was right that he kept saying, "You don't have a warrant. Why are you here? Why are you here?" But there's nothing that suggests that he was so out of it that he couldn't comprehend their answers. He just didn't like the answers. And again, he was able to say, "Well, explain it to me politely. I've been calm from the get-go." He's able to reject his roommate's advice that he just be cool. He doesn't think he has to be cool because he thinks they don't have a warrant, so they can't be here, so I can do whatever I want. And so I think when you look at all that in context, and especially when you consider the fact that the jury heard appellant's testimony, "I don't even remember anything. I was just too drunk." The jury obviously rejected that, and on review, again, under any standard review, you have to assume the jury only believed the evidence that supports the state. So there isn't anything here that supports an inference that appellant was so drunk that he just can't be held responsible for anything he said or did.
When we're evaluating the sufficiency of the evidence of the first threat, the one on the kitchen floor, do the circumstances proved that we consider only go up through the time of the first threat, or do the circumstances proved include the entire 17 minutes of the video?
I think that you look at the whole thing here. At least you look at everything up through the third and final threat, because there's sort of a culmination of events here that makes the apprehension reasonable. And again, that's the only real question here. We know there was apprehension. He testified to it. The question is, was it reasonable? And I think it is worth pointing out that we don't only have the very angry and loud, "I'm going to fucking kill you," but then we have, "I wish I could kill your ass." And that's before the "I wish I was in California so I could kill your ass." So even if we disregard the California one because we're not in California, before that he says, "I wish I could kill your ass." Well, again, that's a reasonable apprehension. If someone says, someone with a gun says, I wish I had some bullets so I could shoot you, you might reasonably apprehensive that eventually they're going to get some bullets. And there isn't any requirement that if you say the magic words wish, well, then it's not a threat. This is unlike the Olson case where there's only an expression of hope. And Olson specifically points out that there's no other verbal or physical conduct or threats. And clearly there is here. So you have to look at the big picture, everything all together. And unless the court has additional questions on that, I think I should probably move to the voluntary intoxication defense issue, since that's a slightly more interesting legal issue. On obstructing legal process, this court explained persuasively in Dodd and Serrano that there's nothing in the statute that says you have to intend a particular result. You just have to do something intentional, not accidental. And you have to have knowledge. So yeah, if you didn't know they were cops, you wouldn't have the knowledge necessary. But clearly he knew they were police here. He kept telling them, I pay your salary, blah, blah, blah. And case law makes quite clear, the Fleck case, that when the statute just says intentionally engage in conduct, that's a general intent crime. So under Fleck, and I think that's quoted in the Brzezinski case, where all you have is intentionally engage in conduct, like we have here, that's a general intent crime. The statute doesn't say anything about with intent to cause a particular result. So that's obstructing the process. And then on threats of violence, of course, we've got the Burgum case, which I'm probably mispronouncing, but the case where this court specifically rejected in a precedential decision that threat of violence is a specific intent crime. And we know from Torres and other Supreme Court precedent that's binding that you only get a voluntary intoxication defense if it's a specific intent crime. So we have to follow that. So the only way appellant prevails here is if this court finds that Burgum is no longer good law because now threat of violence has to be a specific intent crime under the Counterman versus Colorado U.S. Supreme Court case. But Counterman says recklessness is a sufficient mens rea. Counterman specifically says you don't need to prove the sort of subjective intent to cause the result. Recklessness is enough. And we know from Minnesota case law that recklessness does not mean specific intent. I've cited that in my brief, too.
What is your the language of 609.075, that phrase, other state of mind, what does that mean in your view?
I don't know. I'm not sure that the legislature had anything in particular in mind there. I don't think any case laws interpreted it. But again, this court has already ruled on this issue in Burgum. So it's not enough for appellant now to argue, well, Burgum was wrong based on the legislative language or something. The only way he can prevail in this court, as opposed to asking the Supreme Court to look at this, is if he could convince you that Counterman means that Burgum can no longer be considered good law. But Counterman just doesn't say anything like specific intent is required under the First Amendment. In fact, it specifically rejects that and says you don't need subjective intent. Recklessness is enough. Here we have conscious disregard. We don't have anything in Counterman that says Burgum's wrong, this has to be a specific intent crime. And again, only specific intent crimes get this jury instruction.
If we were to get to the harmless error part of the analysis, I think appellant's counsel makes a very good point that here we actually have a closing argument where the state pointed out that there was no instruction on the use of intoxication. How do you respond to that?
Well, the state's closing argument was correct. The state said harmlessness isn't an illegal defense. And if you look on page 12 of my brief, I cite some case law in the statute, and it is an illegal defense. What the statute and this court have said is it's simply a factor that the jury may take into consideration in assessing whether the defendant acted with the required intent. And here, the prosecution never said, hey, when you're thinking about conscious disregard, you have to ignore the fact that he was drunk. They never said that. I mean, that was the whole argument here. He was so drunk that he couldn't consciously disregard this. The jury was able to consider that, and the jury rejected it. And with good reason, if you watch having watched the body cam videos. So given that the jury had in front of it the argument, I was just so drunk, I couldn't think, I didn't consciously disregard anything, and rejected it, any error here was harmless. And I've cited a case in my brief that talks about failure to give, I think it's I think it's the Olson case, that talks about the failure to give an instruction like this is not like an affirmative misstatement of the law, and so it's much more likely to be harmless. And here, again, the jury had all the facts before it. If the jury believed him, they certainly would and could have said, we just think he was too drunk to consciously disregard anything, and therefore he's not guilty. But the jury didn't do that. And I think those are the primary points I wanted to make today. Unless this court has any additional questions, I'll relinquish my final 1 minute and 34 seconds.
Thank you, counsel. Appears to be no other questions.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you'll now have 5 minutes. You may approach.
So the only question on sufficiency is not only if it was reasonable apprehension. There's also the question of his mental state. That did Mr. Sprouls say in his head, "This will cause extreme fear"? Me saying I'm going to kill you, completely unarmed, handcuffed, two officers holding down. Will this cause extreme fear? It might, and I'm going to say it anyway. That is what the court also has to decide, that he had that mental state where he was recklessly disregarding a substantial risk of causing extreme fear in the officers. And it's important for the court to look at the entire video and the circumstances that happened after the threat, because the victim's reaction, it isn't a necessary element, but it's circumstantial evidence of intent. And you can get that from the case Schweppe. The victim's reaction to the alleged threat is circumstantial evidence of the intent of the person that said the alleged threat. So even if there's no circumstantial evidence for reasonableness, there is circumstantial evidence for his mental state and the reaction of the officers acting so nonchalantly, letting him get up within 3 minutes after an intent, after saying that he was killed or that he would kill them. That
counsel,
is circumstantial.
Can I ask you how do you respond? The respondent made a good point that in the sense that officers are trained to de-escalate, and so is it probably true that that particular inference just doesn't work well in a when law enforcement is doing their proper role of de-escalation, but might still have that fear? In other words, the inference just doesn't seem like it works real well in that situation.
Well, the thing is you're looking at it from the appellant's point of view. And from the appellant's point of view, these are officers who are trained to know what is a real threat and what isn't a threat. And they deal with very intoxicated people all the time. They deal with very rude people all the time. They deal with drunk people being very rude to them and threatening them often. And so I think that actually cuts the other way, where if you're speaking to a layperson on the street saying, I'm gonna kill you, right? That layperson might say, what? might have some more reasonable fear. When someone's saying that to an officer who has to deal with the public generally at their worst, I think you would know saying it to an officer that they have dealt with this kind of thing before, and they would be more likely to know when somebody is really intoxicated, completely unarmed, and being held down by two officers, that it wouldn't be reasonable for the officers to actually be scared in that moment.
Testimony from the officers that they were trained in de-escalation techniques, and so they were being very calm and not, sort of goes back to the discussion we had previously, that they weren't exhibiting anxiety or fear. Was there any testimony along those lines?
There was, actually. The officer testified that he actually let Mr. Sprouls get up as kind of an unconventional de-escalation technique. He said that sometimes they let people kind of get up and take a little distance from them in order to let them calm down, and he actually said it worked at first. And an officer, I can't remember if it was Pleen or the other officer, testified that, you know, he was kind of going in and out. He would calm himself down. He would have some moments of more peace, and then he would kind of get himself riled up, saying, "You didn't have a warrant. Why are you here?" And would get kind of stuck in these loopholes. And then that would end in what was an alleged threat. And so it was kind of a cycle that was going through, and the officers were attempting to de-escalate, and they did testify to that, yes. I'd also like to point out with Fleck, the footnote that talks about mental state, The Fleck opinion says when a statute simply prohibits a person from intentionally engaging in the prohibited conduct, it's a general intent crime. In the same paragraph, they expand upon general intent in Fleck and say the defendant intended to do the physical act forbidden without proof that he meant to or knew that he would violate the law or cause a particular result. And the statute that describes the intentional mental state very clearly says that you have to intend the particular result. The Jurgum case also has said the legislature has indicated when criminal intent is an element of the crime, that is, specific intent crimes, such intent is indicated by the term intentionally or with intent to. And I think this kind of trying to chasm intent versus intentionally versus with intent to, those are all grouped together in the same part of the statute with essentially the same definition. And I'd also like to say we're not asking this court to overturn Jurgum. We're asking that you apply the plain language of the statute to have recklessness in the First Amendment context apply. That's my time.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate both counsel's answers to our questions this morning, as well as your briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement. Within 90 days, we'll be issuing our opinion. You each have a good day.